Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about the fallacy that being a cop is the most dangerous job in America, white terrorism in North Carolina and in Kansas, and later in the show we'll talk about the darker sides of being unemployed in America. But before we can move on, Chicago police, who ran a CIA-style black site, a decades-long torture ring, and a massive racist stop-and-frisk dragnet larger than New York, among other things, are now engaging in an attempt to justify their wanton brutality, racism, and penchant to kill innocent people. They've released the video of a police officer being beaten during an altercation with a suspect. Allegedly, this is evidence that the police are always in constant and significant danger, always fear for their lives, and should always pull their guns first and shoot before they ask questions. This is, of course, it might be something that speaks to this whole idea that there's two sides to the story of policing. But in fact, there really isn't. Let's look at some actual facts, shall we? First and foremost, cops commit violence 7 times more than violent acts are committed against them. They kill people 9 times more than when they are killed. This year, there have been 100 line of duty deaths of police officers, and already the police in 2016 have killed 849 people, which certainly puts them on track for the average 1,000 people killed a year by cops over the past 10 years. Policing is also not the most dangerous job in America. In fact, policing is less dangerous than, and this is in order, logging, commercial fishing, airplane pilots, roofers, garbage men, farmers, steel workers, truck drivers, power line workers, taxi drivers, construction supervisors, and maintenance workers. Cops coming in there rounding out at about 15. So, yes, it's more dangerous to pick up the trash for a living than to be a cop. The police know, however, that they cannot allow that fact to be known, because then more people might question why they beat and kill so many people. So they have to create a perception that their job is so dangerous that their murderous ways are totally justified and help keep the climate of impunity around police killings alive and well. So just remember, when the police try to tell you how dangerous their job is, that taxi drivers are more likely to be killed on the job than cops. And while we're on the subject of police information about what the reality is with police killings, FBI Director James Comey testified in front of Congress again about how things aren't really that bad. The ultimate irony is that Comey claims police departments need to rebuild trust in communities, but then tries to act as if the things causing the distrust do not actually happen. Comey claims there is no quote-unquote epidemic of police murders because there's not any sort of comprehensive reporting, and that more comprehensive reporting is needed. This is the ultimate way of playing with words, suggesting that Webster's definition of epidemic is not met. Clearly, what people are referring to, though, is the totally ridiculous nature of the roughly 1,000 murders a year by police, 2.5 times more likely to affect black Americans, which clearly is happening. And we actually do have good numbers about this. They just aren't kept by actual law enforcement agencies, but by journalists like those at The Guardian. Whatever we call it, it's 100% clear that there is a problem in America with the police killing people for no reason, and it clearly disproportionately affects black people. It'd be nice if our first black president would control his FBI director making false statements like that. Republican Party headquarters in North Carolina was firebombed recently and spray painted with graffiti likening Republicans to Nazis. Whether this was a real terror attack by Republican opponents or some desperate false flag trying to swing the election in a key state is yet to be known. That being said, it isn't really surprising someone might target the GOP. Beyond the basic fact that the North Carolina GOP has been waging a campaign for some time to prevent many black people from voting and demonizing the trans community, their announced nominee for president has also been stirring up maximum hatred against, it seems like, almost everyone who is not white and male. Donald Trump has routinely incited his supporters to violence and implied they should take extra legal measures to fight back against the giant conspiracy he says is trying to prevent him from being elected. So it really is no surprise that someone decided to, excuse the expression here, fight fire with fire. Many liberals are wringing their hands over this, and the North Carolina Democrats are actually raising money to help them rebuild their office. As far as I'm concerned, North Carolina Republicans are reaping what they've sown. You can't have it both ways. You can't have a presidential campaign that insinuates there's going to be street fighting if Trump doesn't win, and perhaps even at the polls on election day, and then get mad when street fighting tactics get used right back at you. Last Friday, a group of three white supremacist terrorists were arrested for planning a plot to create what they called a bloodbath of Somali Muslims in the city in Kansas in which they lived. They had speculated on all sorts of attacks, but had settled on setting bombs like Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the Federal Center in Oklahoma City in the 1990s. They decided to take this action to, quote, wake up the white American populace to the Muslim takeover of the nation. The three were undone when one of the terrorists hit his girlfriend, and before they could develop a plan to kill her, which they were talking about, she turned them into the cops. And this should be a reminder that since 9/11, radical white supremacist terrorists have killed more people than so-called radical Islamists in the U.S. In fact, these right-wing extremists have killed about double the number of people of those claiming to be inspired by Islam. These white terrorist groups are not something that's new to the country. And in fact, America's been pretty consistent with that post-Civil War. White people who hate non-white people form terrorist groups and do a fair amount of killing. Also, they almost always cloak themselves in an ideology that uses Christian symbolism and beliefs. Which is why I must ask, when will our leaders decry radical Christianity and take on the scourge of white terrorism? We can only defeat our enemy by naming it. When will Trump declare his plan to knock the hell out of the neo-Nazi movement? Hillary, will you implement a no-fly zone over Idaho? Hopefully, the upcoming presidential debate this week will deal with the fact that we desperately need a plan to derail the dangerous white-led conspiracy to destroy the country, growing just underneath our noses. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are happy to be joined in studio for this conversation by Ty Hobson Powell, a youth advocate and motivational speaker, and Sean Blackman, a Sputnik News analyst. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, I certainly think there's a lot to get into here. And so I want to start with this issue of the FBI. We've got James Comey, who's Obama's employee, the director of the FBI, so totally under control of the president. Now, he's made a number of super inflammatory statements that are false at this point. First, there was the whole Ferguson effect thing. Now saying that there's no real issues of police killings. It's just a few videos or whatever. I mean, I don't know. And Ty, I'll start with you here on this. I mean, what does it say about the first black president that he seems unwilling or perhaps even unable to even control his own employee making false statements?
I mean, the issue of dealing with police and sort of mending that relationship between police as an institution and the community that they service is a touchy topic. I guess by technicality, like you said, it falls short of a frequency where we could call it an epidemic. However, the statistics are staggering. You look at the proportion of the killings that are targeted towards African-Americans, particularly African-American males. So, I mean, it was no different than politics as usual in the sense that, like, we always talk around things without substantively addressing them. But the reality still exists. There's definitely an issue between communities of color and police that police those communities. And I think that the only way that we bridge those gaps is by first being honest and admitting that there is an issue, whether we call it an epidemic or not, that falls entirely on press secretaries, but acknowledging that there is an issue and then coming together and realizing that we have to listen to each other. You know, the fight or flight instinct that is triggered in the hearts of many people of color during their interactions with law enforcement is similar to the same fear in the families of those law enforcement officers when they go out each and every day to suit up for work. And I think in 2016, we can do everything in our power to quell both of these side fears, you know? But that has to happen with love. It has to happen with understanding. It has to start with cops that love the institution that they stand for so much that they are willing to sit there and to take charge and to speak up and to act when somebody is acting inconsistently with the principles that they stand on. So it's a complicated issue, but like I said, I think now, just with the availability of information, now we have a world where everybody has a smartphone and can sort of force that conversation where we're seeing that these things are happening, because the whole issue of there being a divide between police and the communities they police, that's not a new thing. But what's new is the fact that with every smartphone, with every Twitter account, with every Facebook, we can now push that conversation and force it to the national forefront.
Well, and you know, Sean, I think Ty hits on a great point, which is, I mean, acknowledging there is a problem. I mean, it just sort of seems like here we are in this situation where, I mean, you know, it's clear there's an issue. And then somehow the director of the FBI is out here trying to say that there isn't, or, to, you know, earlier to blame it, or to, you know, to say the Ferguson effect is responsible for the increase in murders. I mean, it's just so wanton. It just seems like there's such a fiction in this society where it's like, oh, well, all cops aren't bad, which, like, I think is probably true, but that, you know, it's the old saying, a few bad apples spoil the whole bunch. So it's not just like it's a handful of people doing the wrong thing, but that these people are not, all of them become complicit when they don't stand up. And I think that's a huge issue. I mean, can we ever really start the ball rolling on this if, you know, the people at the highest level in law enforcement are refusing to even acknowledge it exists?
Absolutely not. And what James Comey is doing is actually a pretty typical tactic I see implemented by white people, particularly, who don't want to acknowledge the reality of racism, white supremacy, and systemic oppression in this country. Because when it's brought up, they say, you know, unless you can show me a pie chart or a bar graph or a Venn diagram or something that says, yes, racism is real, then they don't believe it. And that's because as people, of course, who don't face systemic oppression because of race, the only way that they could really understand it is if, you know, the numbers show it. But everything can't be quantified quite that way. The fact is, I mean, we know this country is built on racial terrorism. It's built on the systemic oppression of Native Americans and African people. And, you know, no amount of statistics can really deny that fact, nor can deny that fact that that very basic fact of oppression from the outset affects relations amongst people in this society today. And that's why I think it's so important that we have a progressive movement, a movement that's in the streets pushing this issue, because that's the only way that it will ever be put to the forefront, because we can never expect folks who hold these positions of institutional power, like Director James Comey, or whether it's Barack Obama, a black man himself, to bring this up. They stand to lose if systemic oppression is actually addressed in a critical way to actually try to address it. So that's why there has to be something else coming along. Now, to the point of supposedly improving relations with police and the community they serve, I actually think that whole conversation has been very dishonest. I had someone ask me that question before. They said, Sean, how do you think black community can improve its relationship with the police? And my thing is this. I could never hope to improve my relationship with someone that can kill me and get away with it. It's just impossible. If I know you have that ability, there is no way that we can ever have some kind of friendly dealings. And the reason I say the conversation around this has been designed is because it's always posed as if the civilians have to do something different to address the problem. It's always, you know, how should people dress? How should people act? All we're told is, you know, you should comply, comply, comply. But we've seen later, you can comply and still get killed. Or you can comply and still get shot, like the gentleman down in Florida. You see what I mean? And that's completely bogus, because as civilians, we're not, we don't, you know, walk around completely, you know, outfitted with a gun, a baton, a taser, mace, and a blue wall of silence and a vicious reactionary union to protect us. The police do. Civilians are not given a license to kill by the state. That can never be revoked. The police do. So what we actually have to talk about is what can the police as an institution do to change this murderous reality, not what civilians, not what the victims can do, because we're in the receiving end of this brutality.
Yeah.
Just really, really, really quickly.
No, please go ahead.
If I could chime in, you know, I definitely totally agree with that. To that end, my call to action is more a call to action for the police and not for us, because the reality is, like you said, we are not the offending party here. We are often the victims of this unjust system. And so, you know, to that end, I do agree with what you said. As far as us having that conversation, though, I think that there is something to be said about us literally just sitting down at the table and being honest with each other about what goes on and what doesn't. You know, I talked to the head of a Metropolitan Police Department's First District, Robert Conti, who is a young African-American guy who grew up in the city. And, you know, he said the reality is we don't have enough police. We don't have enough police that look like us, that come from the communities that we come from. He's somebody that came from the city of Washington, D.C., and is now able to actively control the way that police and community relations are done in D.C. to the extent that he controls a large swath of land in D.C. So I think that that conversation is, while the weight of the action needed falls on police, there are definitely things that we can do. But the reality is no amount of body cameras, no amount of legislation, no sensitivity training can really change the underlying racial dynamic that contributes to why police and community relations are the way they are.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a good point. And we're going to take a break before coming back, but I think I definitely want to touch on that and how we portray a lot of the communities and the things that are happening here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation around so many of the things that are just so pressing with race in America. And we continue to be joined in the studio, continue to be joined for this conversation, by Ty Hobson Powell, who's a youth advocate and motivational speaker, and Sean Blackman, who's a Sputnik News analyst. And where we left off, I thought was a great point, that Ty had raised in regards to just the level of truth and the level of reality about what's going on in certain communities. And I think that in and of itself, and I'll start with you again, Ty, is a huge issue in how our community is often portrayed. I mean, here you have this issue where people are going to say, well, you know, it's thousands of people getting shot in Chicago. It's worse than it's ever been. But the national murder rate is lower than it's ever been. Even in Chicago, it's not even the highest it's ever been in Chicago. But yet and still, we still have a news media to a large degree that is portraying it as if, like, you know, this is Vietnam out here. And, you know, many of the black communities in this country. I mean, how much do you think that that is also impacting our inability to have a truthful conversation, that the so-called mediator in this, the media, is going with such a false narrative?
Oh, absolutely plays a big role. I mean, I'll just use my personal story as an example, right? I graduated from high school at 13 years old. I graduated from college at 15 years old. I got my master's degree at 17 years old. I was born and raised in the nation's capital. How many people have heard of me nationally? But if I were a murderer, if I were a thief, then that narrative would have been plastered all over CNN, all over Fox, all over this and that. The reality is that media does and has done for a long time what I like to call the sensationalism of all the wrongs. They sensationalize those narratives that are divisive, those narratives that would otherwise encourage a white man speaker candidate who may not have otherwise had an interaction with a black guy to have these preconceived notions about what black men are based on what he sees on the news every day. And that programming, after a while, you have to say to yourself that it's intentional. And so to that end, I believe that media is responsible for driving a wedge in race relations. In a world where you have Fox News networks that they can say the outlandish things that they say on some of their programming and get away with it. But the fact that they also have millions of viewers that are listening to it, some of them seriously subscribing to it, some of these people who will go on to be legislators or police officers, you know, and then it's a wonder why, you know what I'm saying, people come into situations with the biases that they do. But the reality is that media definitely feeds that a great deal. And, you know, I ask that moving forward, we just have more tasteful media representation. I know that's pretty much of a hard ask, but it's something that we need. If we ever expect to drive this conversation forward in a substantive and progressive way, we first have to start off by depicting things like how they are. You turn on the news. And growing up as a young kid in D.C., for me turning on the news, I knew that my destiny was to become an athlete, a criminal, or an entertainer. Now, the only reason I knew otherwise was because I had a father in my life who told me that I could dictate what role that I played to the world. But think about the kids around this country that do not have that figure, that are turning on the TV and seeing on the nightly news a guy that looks like them and saying, man, that's me. Because they aren't being shown or advanced any other narratives that are uplifting, that are powerful. Then, like I said, on the other end, imagine these communities, these Caucasian communities that are looking at the news so far removed from the black community that the only sort of introspection that they have
only sort of perspective they have, rather, on the black community is what they're getting from the news. And this is 30-second soundbites about all of us being criminals. How do you think that that's going to play out? Like, naturally, media is feeding that divide.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Sean, you know, I mean, you are a Sputnik News analyst. You work in the media. You are a journalism major at the, you know, not quite Howard, but still excellent university, Florida A&M in Tallahassee. Is it, I mean, it seems like the media, you know, to some degree, people say, oh, well, it's nonpartisan. It's both sides, blah, 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 blah. And I guess I feel two ways about it. I mean, I feel almost like taking two sides of the fence or being like, we got to show both sides is partisan. I mean, like, if you look at the way the James Comey story was reported in a lot of areas, it's like, well, the FBI director went to Congress and he said X, Y, Z, and, you know, someone maybe said that wasn't true, when, like, it's definitely not true. But when we play this game of, well, you know, both sides sort of have this equivalent whatever, that, you know, maybe sometimes there's, you know, disputed facts that we don't know, but then a lot of times it creates, like, this false, you know, equivalency between things that are, like, clearly false. And so as someone who is a journalist, I mean, I wonder how you parse that.
Right. Well, first of all, I'm going to let that dig at FAMU go for now. But what we're really talking about here, whether we're talking about the media or the police, we're talking about the nature of institutions, not how they portray themselves, but the very nature of how they operate and the implications of their actions, not the things they say. Right. And I believe it was Huey Newton that said something to the effect of, you know, we can't trust, you know, the media to have accurate, you know, depictions of black men. But that I think that could be extrapolated to, you know, any oppressed or marginalized group. So we may look at something like Fox News, something that's so blatantly reactionary and right wing, and look at that as the bad news. And then look at supposedly more centrist or liberal media like CNN and think of that as good. But the fact of the matter is that they, you know, they to the point the brother was making, they stand to profit, you know, from the suffering and the sensationalization and the kind of skewed images that we see. I don't think, I mean, speaking from a point of the movement for Black Lives, I don't think that, you know, any media had any fair representation of things that are going on. They were the movement's all been made out to be a bunch of just a lot of wanton violence and random destruction with no sort of base or even reason. And that's just one example. You see what I mean? And connecting that to the police, that's why I say that, you know, that institution as a whole has to be changed, because it's repressive and murderous by its very nature. It's not just the notion of individuals. And it's kind of like, and I take issue a little bit with the notion that, you know, what we need is more officers of color. Because, I mean, you know, three of the officers responsible for the death of Freddie Gray are black. I remember, I feel like a few years ago in D.C., there was a young kid that was killed by police, Deontay Rollins. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe he was killed by police that knew him personally. And I also think, and when you can correct me on this, this is incorrect, but I believe that Metropolitan police officers a lot of times actually request to not live in D.C. or necessarily in the communities they police. You see what I mean? And so it's, you know, you don't have to be white to be in service to white supremacy. And also know that, you know, our mayor in D.C., Muriel Bowser, who was also black, tried to pass a draconian crime bill that would have flooded Southeast D.C. with cops. You see what I mean? So, I mean, even though we have people in positions that come from oppressed nationalities or oppressed ethnicities, the institutions that they're a part of are repressive. So they could be the most progressive person in the world. But if the institution itself that they're a part of is one that's responsible for the kind of terror that we're seeing, then that's what, in fact, has to change, not just necessarily a switching out of the faces of who's in the position.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with that point, man, because, you know, although there are definitely some underlying racial issues that contribute to a lot of the stories that we see about young brothers and young sisters being deprived of life so early, I also am quick to acknowledge that it is an issue of community versus institution. It is less a black and white issue as much as it is a black versus blue issue in many cases, because I've had African-American cops badger me and mess with me more than I've had Caucasian cops mess with me, you know? So it goes to show that it's to a point where when you look at the scale of militarization in local policing and just what that encourages, how this aggressiveness, this hyper enforcement by police is being done in a way that transcends racial dynamics. So I totally agree with you there, man.
Well, and I think it's a good point. And I want to try to switch gears here in kind of a bigger way, and we might come back to some of this, but some unique experience I know you have, Ty, that I think is relevant to the news. So I know you went to Liberty University for your master's. You graduated at 17. Fantastic work. Liberty played a big role in politics, especially over the past week or so. The president there, Jerry Falwell Jr., sort of doubling down on Donald Trump, while, a significant group of students have now come out and created a group that is, speaking out against some of the things that he has said that they think are out there. And I wonder, just as we have this conversation about, like, sort of the role of faith in America, obviously that was a question in the vice presidential debate. I mean, do you feel that this is representative, what we're seeing at Liberty, of sort of a broader disconnect between sort of who we usually look at as our quote-unquote religious leaders who are so political and so involved with the politicians and all those games, and younger people of faith who are looking to perhaps have an existence that's more in tune and less hypocritical with the values that, folks are often, these same leaders, preaching on Sunday?
I mean, you have to understand there is a long-standing relationship between the institution Liberty University and the right wing, just off the basis of them being founded on Christian principles. I remember when I went there, Barack Obama was on his reelection cycle, and they actively tried to undermine his second attempt to become president. They had Mitt Romney come down and speak to our school a couple of days before election. They actually had Donald Trump come down and do some stomping. And I guess you could use some of that as a justification for why there is that endorsement, of such a firm endorsement from the institution Liberty University. When you look at the principles that conservatives stand on, diehard, hardcore conservatives, it's usually, abortion, things like that, things that they are unwavering in. And so to that end, they'll support the candidate that follows those principles. But I think the idea that we can try to compare Hillary Clinton's missteps, be it email, Benghazi, whatever you want to do, to Donald Trump's ignorance, and then try to tie that to faith, that's something that I see no connection with. As a man of faith myself, I just totally see all the hate and xenophobia that he's preaching is something that's incongruent with the stuff that my God is teaching me or passed down to be taught to me. So I think that's why you see very, very, very vocal young people that aren't a part of that, very, 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 very aged mentality that says that we just have to stick to our guns and stick with the candidate. Sometimes doing the right thing looks like working with somebody who may have some differences with you, but realizing that as far as sensible leadership goes, as far as leadership that would promote the type of unity that we hope that God envisions for us as society, it doesn't look like supporting people that are hateful just because they fall under your party lines, you know?
No, I think it's a good point, and it raises another issue that I'm curious what you think about, Sean, too, because, Russell Moore, who's a high-level official with the Southern Baptist Convention, he gave a interview to Bloomberg recently, Bloomberg View, about sort of the state of the evangelical community, and they said, well, what do you think some of the number one things are, like three biggest, things that younger, millennial-aged evangelicals want to really deal with and what's important to you. And he's opposed to Trump, just for people who are listening, Russell Moore. And I was surprised he listed three, but one of them was healing the racial divide in America. And then I put that together with the Pew poll that showed the only area where 50% of white people thought that there was, real racism was the courts and the police. You have, I think, a majority of younger white millennials saying that they think this should be one of the most important issues for the next president. Is that a sign that, even beyond, it's almost like that the movement for Black Lives, obviously everyone is not agreeing with every particular piece of the platform, but if it's becoming a broader cultural movement, if from the evangelical community, sort of the more Republican-oriented one, to, sort of radical people, whoever you're outside of politics to some degree, there seems to be now this growing consensus, particularly among younger people, that there's a serious problem with race in this country and that something has to be done.
Yeah, well, firstly, I got to say, I'm very wary of any comment like that coming from the Southern Baptists. We know that, they were pretty much established because they thought that slavery was an institution ordained by God. And I happen to know, my father's a Baptist minister, happen to know that the Southern Baptists have been really trying to make inroads with Black churches. They even have basically like a African-American like outreach department. You see what I mean? I think trying to sort of rehab, their image as right-wing racist. Now, Having said that, I do believe in, I believe what you're saying is true, and I do believe in functional unity. You know, I believe it was Raul Castro said unity does not exclude honest discrepancy. But having said that, I'm most interested to see for folks who speak this way, I'm always most interested in what sort of things they're actually willing, you know, to support. So does healing the racial divide just mean that, you know, he has more black folks in the pews on Sunday? Or do folks really want to seriously and critically and honestly address the institutional and systemic issues that create this inequity?
Yeah, well, we'll try to get Russell Moore on the show at some point and maybe figure out what that is. I did not know your father was a Baptist minister. I did know he's a minister. Is there any I was going to ask you a question that now I know it's, I don't want to be too frivolous. It's an important question, but you know, Greenleaf is one of my favorite shows. So whenever someone tells me they're the son of a Baptist minister, I got to know, are they anything like Pastor Greenleaf? But I'm sure your father's not flying around in private jets. But, you know, I think
absolutely
it's a,
not.
I think it's a good question, though. I think it's a good question to see and to look at, you know, how sort of the underlying cultural changes. I mean, this is really more of a comment than a question to anyone, but I think it's relevant to what we see happening in the country. You know, you look at the politics and the positions and this and the third, but really broad cultural changes are what makes so much of the difference. And you look at what's happened, for example, with the LGBTQ community. I mean, even just the fact that so many of the things that Trump has said that if we're being honest, 50 years ago would be like, whatever, now are like, whoa, how could you ever say that, at least in public? I think is a sign that sometimes these broad cultural shifts, we don't see them in the same way, but nevertheless, they still affect us in a way that I think is, you know, really quite interesting in terms of how it kind of pops up later on and starts to redefine the political reality. And I think that that's an interesting point. But nevertheless, we could talk about this all day, every day, but we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to take another break before we come back with more on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. Thanks to Ty Hobson Powell and Sean Blackman for joining the show. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Again, we are going to take a break. We will be back. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about an issue that always hangs over every election. It's the economy, stupid, as they said several other ones. Some of the darker sides of unemployment, issues with jobs crisis, what the presidential candidates are overlooking, and we'll see what else we get to. That's a lot of interesting stuff. We are joined by Logan Martinez, who's the outreach coordinator for the National Jobs for All Coalition. Logan, thanks so much for being on the show.
I really appreciate you guys having us on.
No, of course, of course. And so where I wanted to start is, you know, it's, are we underplaying the issue of unemployment and underemployment in the country? I mean, we've got the employment to population ratio at very low numbers historically. We saw the report over the weekend sparked a lead editorial in the New York Times from Alan Krueger about the men dropping out of the workforce, becoming addicted to painkillers. And yet and still we're in a situation where when the economy creates 250,000 jobs a month, there's always sort of like a big celebration until the next month when it's less. So, I mean, I wonder if we aren't really giving this issue enough of its due and really framing it correctly.
That's been an ongoing problem. You know, we've had, you know, a cycle of recessions, and during the heart of the recessions, there's a lot of talk about it. But when it starts to wane down, you know, we've been almost 7 years since the end of the recession, so-called. And in that time, we have long-term unemployment that's in millions and millions of people. And for those folks, they become just the statistics on home foreclosures, and their cars get repossessed, and they have, you know, relation problems and all kinds of other problems that go with unemployment. But it gets covered, but it just, you know, sort of like has yet to been really addressed in a significant way.
Yeah, no, well, I think it's a good point, and I think you raise a good point about people becoming statistics, and that was certainly the upshot of the Kruger report with the drug use piece. I mean, I also wonder, like, you know, if someone was to say, if I was to say, you know, whatever, if I spoke from the well of Congress, well, you know, we need more money for job training program. I'm sure someone on the Republican side, maybe even the Democratic one, might say, well, how are we going to pay for all this? How are we going to afford it? As if people not having jobs is free. I mean, there's a tremendous social cost here, it seems, not just from, you know, people drawing benefits from unemployment and disability, but the fact that people, you know, are turning to drugs and other things like that in the sense of despair, psychological problems that they have, that there's a tremendous social cost to having such huge unemployment in America.
There's all kinds of, you know, there's a social cost and there's a concrete cost. You know, we in the Midwest here and in lots of cities across the country, we have Rust Belt conditions in which we have large segments of our, you know, cities that are, you know, just ghettos and run down and abandoned buildings and people just, you know, scraping by in those areas of high concentration of poverty and unemployment. The cost of that, you know, like we what we say here in the National Jobs for All Coalition is that, you know, through a job for all and through full employment, it would be really good for the whole society, and it would be good for business, and it would be good for working people across the board.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a very good point. And I also, you know, wonder, how do you think that part of the reason, and I don't know if maybe it's some of the reason, I mean, it used to be that one of the main sort of things that they say, certainly the Federal Reserve is tasked with this, is, you know, full employment was a goal. It was something that the government wanted to reach. It was something that people talked about. But I mean, now it just seems like the way these issues is reported is it's so pie in the sky that, you know, really kind of across the political spectrum, even though people say they want to create more jobs, we've sort of lost the horizon of full employment. I mean, how important do you think it is to, you know, whatever, however it takes to get there and whatever the individual pieces are, that we start to reinsert into the conversation that this is, it's a good thing that we have full employment and also a possible thing, even if the means may end up being debated.
Absolutely, absolutely. We spend trillions of dollars on the wars and on the defense industry, and, you know, the banks are investing in huge projects that are capital intensive but create very few jobs. And so the money's there. What we lack is the vision. And, you know, at one time there was a lot of people. In fact, the Congress passed the Humphrey Hawkins and Full Employment Act back in the late 70s, early, and never put any teeth in it. You know, and so, you know, we're supporting John Conyers' bill, H.R. 1000, and Marcy Kaptur's bill that reintroduces the three C's. That's H.R. 1966. But those two bills would create millions of good jobs for folks and rebuild our society and really put some energy and resources behind getting there. And they wouldn't break the budget. They would cost lots of billions of dollars, but our society has that money. It's just the lack of will to invest the money that we have into fixing up our society and taking care of our people.
No, I think that's a good point. And since you raised those two bills, H.R. 1000, I'm a little familiar with, but what would those bills do? I mean, here we are, we're having this whole conversation. We're going to have a presidential debate this week. Everyone is going to talk about how they create jobs. I bet you neither of the people will mention either of these bills that are pending, which means they could champion them. But that being said, what would these bills do? How would they tackle this crisis?
Okay. Talk first about H.R. 1000. That's a John Conyers bill. It's supported with about 45 members of Congress have become co-sponsors. And the bill would, in stages, create projects across the board, two kinds of tiers of projects that would be, you know, governed by local communities. And they would be whether they were improving the infrastructure, the housing, regular stuff that you see all the time that needs to be done. But it would also do everything from, you know, helping staff, libraries, child care centers. And it would really be the local community that would be able to institute those projects. It would also provide training for millions of people, so that it would be a ongoing upgrade of people's skill, and they would be paid while they were doing so, and sort of like a, so that it has both those components, and it's funded by a financial transaction tax,
mm-hmm.
which is on stocks. They have this in Europe, and we used to have it here actually, where people engage in selling stocks or bonds and those kind of things. And it's a very small tax of only about 0.5%. And that would generate enough money to create, like, we, you know, 4 or 5 million jobs right off the bat in the first 2 years.
Mm. Wow. So that's, I mean, that's certainly interesting. You know, I just took a look. H.R. 1000 has 42 co-sponsors. I mean, it's not nothing, but obviously many more to get there. I mean, it sounds pretty sound to me. I would at least expect more Democrats to have signed on to that. I mean, what do you think it is that holds back proposals like this? I mean, is it the influence of corporate money in politics?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That, you know, well, H.R. 1000 is modeled under New Deal direct job creation, where the government would fund these projects directly for job creation. The prevailing, you know, approach within the Democratic Party is indirect job creation, where you pump money into the society through other programs, and then there's sort of a ripple effect that would create additional jobs. And that, you know, is effective if people, you know, if they pump enough money into it, but it's very indirect and more cost, it's not very cost efficient because it has, you know, it's sort of a trickle-down approach almost. And so it used to be, you know, you had your old New Deal Democrats who believed in direct job creation and creating a safety net to protect people. And that, you know, there's, I'd say, a sizable number of people that still believe that, but they don't want to really deal with the hard fight to get those that kind of job creation into law.
No, I hear you. I think that's 100% true. And it's funny you even raise it in that context, too, because I know that Mr. Fisher, the vice chair of the Federal Reserve, was saying recently that they were close to their target on trying to reach full employment. But you can see how much money they've pumped in there and how people have not been reinvesting it. And I think it's an interesting piece. And, you know, the other thing that I think is big here is, and when we talk about job creation, is we talk so much about unemployment, but also the issue of underemployment. In a USA article, they had a lead article today about the 8-year high of people, about 5% of the people in the job market holding two jobs. I mean, how important is it that when we also talk about jobs, we talk about the quality of the jobs and the wages and benefits attached to it, so that we're not just sort of putting more people in the workplace, but in a way that they still, you know, are having trouble making ends meet?
Well, there's several components to that. The whole, and just the step back, the notion that we're anywhere near full employment is absolutely wrong and not true. That our group estimate there's almost nearly 20 million people that are unemployed and underemployed. There's official unemployment for last month was 5%, which is almost 8 million people. There are 30 million people working part-time.
Mm.
About 6 million of those people are desperately needing a full-time job. About 6 million. And then there are about 6 million more people who are not even counted but are unemployed, the hidden unemployed. And so you take those together and it's like 19.9 million people, almost 20 million people that are unemployed and underemployed. And the part-time employment, like you were saying, is you know, about 7 million people who work, of the 30 million people who are working part-time, only work 14 hours a week. And, you know, lots of these are like minimum wage or very close to minimum wage jobs, and there's no way people can make ends meet. And if you're working minimum wage and you're lucky enough to work full-time, you're at best treading water, and sometimes, you know, your utilities get turned off. Sometimes you don't have the things your kids need. You certainly can't go to the doctor when you need to go, and you can never go to the dentist. And so the hardship that it costs the people, you know, 45 million Americans live below the poverty line. And it's a combination of unemployment and underemployment and just no safety net there to really protect people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that raises a great question, too. I mean, that's a huge number. I mean, is one of the difficulties in people wrapping their head around this is that we often use percentages and not raw numbers. So if you see something that might be like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12%, it sounds like, well, that's not that many people. But then when you see it's tens of millions of people, totally different reaction you get.
Absolutely. I mean, they do that, and you know, even when they do give you the number, it's hard to even contemplate just how many people in your community that are just, you know, scraping by. And you know, even the working class and the middle classes are having trouble holding, you know, making ends meet. The cost of living is so high for folks.
Well, and it makes you wonder sort of when we embed the issue of jobs. I mean, because it's, you know, I think so often the way this comes up is it's sort of like, well, jobs is an issue, healthcare is an issue, blah, 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 blah. It's like all these separate issues. But for people who are sort of in this circumstance, unemployed, underemployed, I mean, it seems that like what we really have to start talking about is not just the job per se, but then just sort of the broader context of what our society is about. I mean, especially in terms of the quality of jobs is who's going to provide the healthcare, how we're going to pay for it, what are we going to do about housing, how are we going to keep costs down, that we have to have really a more sort of comprehensive jobs agenda as opposed to just trying to sort of, you know, narrow it down to like the numerical X number of people having jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. That's our group definitely believes that, you know, we're the richest country in the history of humanity. And, you know, we have just this tremendous inequality that, you know, just doesn't exist in Western Europe. I mean, it does, but not to the extent that it does here. And there's a saying that goes back, I don't know where it comes from, but, you know, if your neighbor loses your job, it's a recession. If you lose your job, it's a depression. And when you're the person that's unemployed and it's not your relative, it's not your neighbor or friend, you really learn really quick how hard it is to try to survive in this society without an income.
Well, and the other issue, and I think this is, you know, a smaller issue, but well, not a smaller issue, an issue that's sort of further down the scale, at least in the current environment, how we talk about this, is unionization. I mean, it seems like, you know, when you looked at when it was the higher wages, better sort of keeping up with the cost of living, it was because people had this mechanism by which they could negotiate with their employer as a force to raise their wages and improve their benefits. Now we've gotten so far away from that, and it seems like that if we're going to have this conversation in a real way, we have to reconnect the issue of unionization with high-quality jobs.
Absolutely. You're down to under 9% of the workforce that's unionized across the board. And that's just, you know, 1 out of 10 worker that has that kind of protection. There's all kinds of stuff that goes with having a union, the wages and benefits for sure, but there's just the kind of job security that you don't have if you're just, you know, hired by the boss on a day-by-day basis. You know, we saw they passed this Puerto Rican bailout plan, and part of that bailout plan was to reduce wages for people in Puerto Rico. They reduced the minimum wage for people under 26 to 4-something an hour. Well, I don't think it started yet, but we'll see jobs moving from the mainland to Puerto Rico to you know, and these are people that have families and trying to live on $4 an hour. And their economy is pretty much comfortable to ours, but they're going to be, you know, how can you pay rent and have a life and make $4.50 an hour?
No, I hear you. I think that, I mean, it's unbelievable. And I think we see that so many times where, you know, these big deals that are coming down, dealing things, the auto bailout and other things like that, where, you know, there's always direct attacks on labor unions. But, you know, huge issue. There's so much that we could say in all of this. We're going to have to leave it there for today's show. But a big thanks to Logan Martinez, who is with the National Jobs for All Coalition. He's the outreach coordinator there based out of Ohio. And that is going to do it for our show today on By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements that are shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.